across the city
and South Cambridgeshire.
This is Julian Clover.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Cambridge 105 Radio. It's 11:32 on a Sunday morning, Sunday brunch. Julian Clover with you this week, and joined now by Dan Jones. He is a physical oceanographer with the British Antarctic Survey. He's going to be taking part, amongst a number of people actually, in a panel described as a Meet Your Friendly Neighbourhood Climate Scientists, which is part of the Cambridge Science Festival, which will be with us soon. But Dan, I have to ask, what does a physical oceanographer do all day?
Right. Well, first, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome.
And I would just, to describe what I do, so a physical oceanographer uses physics, things like where does heat go, how do the winds drive around ocean circulation. We use those kind of basic physical principles to try to understand ocean circulation and how the ocean absorbs and stores heat and carbon. How long can the ocean continue to operate as a heat and carbon sink? Because right now, the ocean absorbs some crazy percentage, like 90% of the extra heat added to the climate system via burning adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels, and it absorbs something like 30% of the carbon that we're adding to the atmosphere. So it's doing us a huge service in terms of moderating the rate of climate change here at the surface where we live. So the physical oceanographer, you know, I basically look at physical data. This could be.
So you're getting numbers in, are you, from various sources? Presumably, well, your colleagues may be in the British Antarctic Survey. They presumably take measurements and feed them back to you in Cambridge.
That's part of it. Yeah, that we have right now the British Antarctic Survey. We operate two ships. It's about to be one ship because we're moving towards the new Sir David Attenborough. In the next couple of years, we'll be rolling towards that. But yes, we take measurements of temperature, salinity, the saltiness of the ocean. To try to figure out where the heat is going and how
the saltiness of the ocean. Mm-hmm. How does that come into it?
Oh, well, the saltiness affects the density of the water.
Okay,
and the density plays a big role in terms of where that water ultimately ends up going and how it mixes with the other water masses. You know, you can do this experiment at home. In fact, we just did this with some school kids in Cambridge here on Friday. It was really fun. You take a bucket of fresh water and a bucket of salt water. Put some blue ice cubes in it. You freeze some blue water so that it's a dyed ice cube. And then you place the ice cubes in each one of these buckets, let them melt. And in the fresh water, that blue dye will sink right to the bottom. And in the saltwater case, all that blue dye will just stay right at the top. So that's, you see a big, big difference in terms of how the water mixes and where it goes when you're looking at a fresh bucket of water versus a salty bucket of water. So the salinity is a big part of how the heat can move around in the ocean.
And I guess one of the fears is that sooner or later the ocean won't be able to do us this massive favor anymore.
Yeah, that's one of the concerns, is that, and one of the questions is, you know, to what extent will the ocean continue to be able to absorb heat and carbon into the future? And another big concern is related to the ice around Antarctica and the ice that rests on top of Antarctica, because much of that ice is in contact with the ocean, and that warm water can get up onto the ice shelves and melt them, causing adding to sea level rise and adding to sea level rise and exacerbating that problem. So we're concerned about warm water basically melting the ice that's resting on Antarctica and in contact with the ocean because of that connection to sea level rise, which, as an island, we're especially vulnerable to that and especially sensitive about the possible future impacts of sea level rise.
Mm-hmm. Now, you'll be aware, of course, of the school children protesting on Friday in Cambridge and around the UK. I think in Cambridge there were something like 400 counted. A friend of mine, a reporter on the Cambridge Independent, was there, and makes a pretty good estimate of things. What are your feelings about, well, specifically, first of all, that the kids are going out of school and protesting in the first place, no matter what it's about?
I think that they're sending us, the older folks, a really clear, strong message that This is something that is going, climate change is going to affect their futures, and they're worried that we're not taking it seriously enough. They're worried that we're not doing enough to address the problem. And I think they have a really good point. So, I mean, I support their right to do that. I mean, you know, as a private citizen, you know, I have no,
I guess in part you kind of wish they were in their geography class learning about climate change, but equally sending a message at least once through.
I could see that point, yeah. I mean, there has to be, I could see that point as well, but I think they're within their rights to make some noise. If they want to make some noise and are concerned about the future, I mean, that's part of what young people can be good at, right? That's historically young people can be good at.
But it is unusual, though, isn't it? Unusual that it's so young, and also their chosen topic of protest.
Well, I guess climate change is an issue that's going to unfold over decades and centuries, and certainly over their lifetimes. I mean, the projections for, you know, how much the climate can change over the next several decades is pretty striking. There's a big difference between a world where we do nothing to address climate change and the average temperature just keeps going up and up and up, and we keep seeing more heat waves, heat-related deaths, damage due to sea level rise, more extreme storms, and a world where we do something to address climate change. And there's a variety of things that we could potentially do there. There's a big difference between those two worlds, and I think what I'm hearing is, you know, those kids are sending us a message like, you know, make a choice, do something now, this is your responsibility.
Yeah. It's interesting, on the issue of responsibility, I invited you in and said, well, you don't need a coffee, I see you already got one. Not only do you have what looks like a reusable coffee cup, and you have a reusable water holder, I never know what to call those, other than using the brands, but we all know the sorts of things we're talking about here. You know, is that a realistic thing that we can do? I do. I haven't got it actually on display today. I've got it in my bag, but I did do a similar thing.
I think this helps. I mean, I'm not always perfect about remembering these reusable.
No,
things.
We all get stuck out where we end up having to buy a plastic bottle of water simply because we need the water.
Exactly. So I'm not always perfect about these things. I think, you know, using reusable things like that I have here, one of the good things about that is you save on the energy required to make a new cup every time, and you save on the kind of potential carbon emissions associated with, you know, making a new cup and making a new glass. So I think that's one potential thing. But my feeling is the scale of the changes that we are talking about are just, they're enormous. I mean, they have to do with changing the way that we invest money, changing the way that large firms invest their money, changing the way that potentially that, you know, the way that the university invests its money, for example, like that is something that could potentially need to be changed.
A lot of people unhappy, of course, about the university's approach to carbon fuels.
Yes, yeah, I've heard a lot of discussion about that lately, and that I know that, so Cambridge decided not to divest from fossil fuels, and there are plenty of folks. I spoke with Joanna Depledge, for example, who works associated with the university, and she has some very strong opinions about that, that it would send a, you know, for Cambridge to divest from carbon, that would send a huge message and a huge investment signal, making it clear that this is something that this institution cares about and wants to do. Now, you know, I haven't been a part of those, you know, discussions. I'm not in a position of leadership, so that's totally, you know, that is other folks' responsibility. But it's really interesting debate to listen to.
It's an intriguing one because it's not as if the university doesn't have plenty of people to call on to give them the advice as to what actually is happening.
Yeah, that's true. There's plenty of folks here who can tell them, you know, what kind of climate this is contributing to in the future. I've heard the argument that the argument that I've heard that some people make in terms of, oh, why would you stay at the table? Why would you keep your investments there? And some folks are of the opinion that, well, if you are continue to invest in fossil fuels, you're at the table and you can have a role in influencing the decisions in terms of what that, you know, oil company does. I don't know how big of an effect that really is, but that
depends
that's
how many
the,
seats you have at the table. I suspect that one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, look, Dan, stay with us if you can. We're going to do some travel and there's a quick piece of music as well, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more, maybe about the kind of work you're doing in Cambridge, and also letting us know about the session at the Cambridge Science Festival next month.
Sounds great.
It's 19 before midday. We're chatting this hour with Dan Jones. He's a physical oceanographer with the British Antarctic Survey. He's going to be taking part, amongst other scientists, in Meet Your Friendly Neighbourhood Climate Scientists, which is one of the talks at the Cambridge Science Festival, which is underway next month. Dan, what sort of, we hear quite often of the British Antarctic Survey, but so often it's in the context of what the people on, well, as you mentioned earlier on, two ships right now, soon to be one ship, are doing. But how many of them are you in Cambridge?
In terms of in Cambridge, and I think I'm going to get this number right, I believe it's about 300, 350, and that's between both science and the folks who work on logistics, because the British Antarctic Survey, those are essentially the two big things we do. We do science related to the polar regions, and we do logistics related to the polar regions. That's getting people and supplies down to the Antarctic ships and the Antarctic bases that we manage, like Halley, which sits out on the ice. That's mm-hmm. the big, almost kind of alien pod-looking one that you may have seen that you can drag around on skis if necessary. So that's the kind of two arms of our activity.
Do you get to go out there yourself ever?
I've gotten to go once, so my job is not primarily seagoing, but I did get the privilege to go out a couple of years ago. We went down to the Weddell Sea, which is one of the, if you just go to the Atlantic and go straight south from here.
It sounded like you said Whittlesea for a moment. I got very, very thrown, sorry.
Oh, yeah. Go to the Atlantic, go south from here, and you'll pretty much get to the Weddell Sea. We went out on the sea ice, drilled some sea ice, and brought those samples back up here to Cambridge, where we cut them up and analyzed them. So that was a real treat to get to be a part of that.
Yeah, very much so. You mentioned also some of the outreach work doing with schools. Is that a regular thing? I guess you must be pretty busy in the office and in the lab the rest of the time.
Yeah, I'd say not every week, not every month, but you know, every now and then we have an opportunity to go to a primary school and to do some science demonstrations and to talk about the science we're doing. And I think that's an important part of what we're doing. And I try to volunteer at my son's school, for example, to give talks when they have their science week. So yeah, I enjoy doing that sort of thing. I think it's a good part of my job.
Yeah. So tell me a bit about the session then, which is taking place, I think, 19th of March is when this one is running. And we mentioned the title, Meet Your Friendly mm-hmm. Neighbourhood Climate Scientist, of which you are one, but also Emily Shuckburgh, Heather Ford, Cameron Brick, Ella Gilbert as well mm-hmm. are going to be joining you. What if people sign up for that one, what can they expect?
Well, and there's also Ritwika Sengupta, who has been added to the program recently.
Oh, not on my copy, sorry.
Oh, no worries. Yeah, that's a recent addition. Okay, so what I like to do with these events, and we've been running similar events for a few years now, I like to get a group of climate scientists, climate-relevant scientists together, and put them in a room with people, with the public, basically. And I like that because it seems like past experience shows me, I think people appreciate that opportunity to have that kind of direct contact with people who are working in the field so they can ask them the questions that are on their mind. So we are going to have an interactive question and answer session that I'm going to use this thing called Slido is the plan, to where you can bring your mobile device along and ask questions anonymously. You don't have to download anything. You can participate via your web browser on your phone. So you'll be able to vote in polls. You'll be able to ask questions anonymously, and we'll be taking some of those questions.
Some people do get nervous, mm-hmm. don't they, at these things. You get, you know, the guy two rows in asks all the questions, and you've got an audience of 300 or 400 who actually probably have valid questions too.
Yeah, that's right. So I haven't tried that before, so I'm looking forward to giving it a shot. We'll see. I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm excited about the panel of guests that we have, and we are not going to give a formal lecture, so you're not going to have to sit through, you know, 30, 40 minutes of a lecture. It's going to be, you know, right from the beginning. We're just
quite relaxed, and I also get the impression accessible as well, because mm-hmm. and the whole purpose of the Cambridge Science Festival is to bring, I guess, people like me in to find out what people like you are doing.
That's the point, yeah. Let's put some scientists in a room together with people and just give them an opportunity to talk and interact with each other.
Okay. Well, look, Dan, thank you very much for coming in and chatting with us this morning. I have to ask, I presume the accent is from the States. Whereabouts are you from?
It is. I grew up in the southeast in Georgia, So I have no idea where my accent came from. I can't explain it. It's just here.
And how long have you been in Cambridge for?
5.5 years.
5.5 years. Yeah. Good. Okay. Well, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
To talk to us this morning. Should mention then, if you want to take part in that event, which Dan is behind, then you probably do best to register. It's all free, though, isn't it?
You don't
have to pay to get in. And it's at Highcross on Maddingley Road.
Yes, at the British Antarctic Survey. So you can come visit our place.
Sounds good. Dan, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Dan Jones.
Thank you.
And we'll go up to the news with George Howison. Mighty sweet lord.